welcome to Tech Access Weekly, a podcast of unspecified length concerning news and events in accessible technology. This is episode 20 for January 4th, 2009. Happy second episode of the new year, everyone. This is Aaron here, and Rodney is with me as well.
Hello, hello.
And we are going to talk about a few things. There's not really a whole lot going on right now.
The holiday season isn't known for tech news. Everybody goes on vacation.
But we have a couple of little whimsical things to talk about today, and a few statistical things that may be of interest to some people, as well as some sobering news regarding blind literacy, which we'll touch on in a few minutes. Regarding a couple of interesting statistical things, internet users are now spending an average of 13 hours a week online. This was a study done for adults in various age brackets, and the age bracket, interestingly, that spends the most time online was not the 20 to 29-year-olds like I thought it would be, the younger age bracket, but the 30 to 39-year-olds who spent an average of 18 hours a week online. 50% or so of all the people who spent time online buy something every month, or at least bought something last month. And the article talked a lot about what factors made people spend so much time online. And a lot of it is just people being more tech savvy and getting to know the computer better and feeling more comfortable with the computer. But the author of this article speculated that some of it was due to the recession. Going out costs money. Staying in is free.
Even though people do pay for internet, I guess they're starting to think of internet access as sort of a utility
or a necessity. Exactly. So that not only points to the fact that people are getting more tech savvy, but they're also thinking the internet is more of a necessity that they must have.
I know I feel that way.
Yeah, I know I do too.
But the study also revealed that about 14% of all people surveyed out of, I believe it was 2,100 individuals between July and October, 14% of them actually are on the internet 24 hours a week.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
And
although you probably get there.
Close, but not quite that much. There are a lot more things to do on the internet now, and that's also a factor in this. You don't just go online and read email like you used to. No, don't even just go online and surf the web like you used to. There's all this social networking, Facebook, all these games and things that keep people occupied, and they lose track of time.
That's very true. And to readdress something that we had mentioned in a previous episode, Facebook has security settings that technically do not really work that well as security settings. And the ACLU has a quiz that you can take on Facebook in order to see what Facebook actually knows about you and your friends. You can find this quiz by searching for "What do quizzes really know about you" on Facebook, and it's quite revealing that you pretty much answer the questions with the most shocking and disturbing answer possible.
And that's the right answer.
And that's always the right answer. As far as like your private information, one really interesting part is the fact that when your friends are actually taking quizzes, your information is still being shared with the company that provides that quiz. So that's a little...
That's disturbing.
Yeah, exactly. But I wanted to give that out because we had mentioned it last week. And so if you search for that in the search box on Facebook, you can go right to it. It's sponsored by the ACLU.
Well, I do know that for my part, when I got on Facebook for the first couple of months or so, and every so often I went through these phases, those quizzes can be really addictive. Like, you know, you just click along and click along and don't really think about what information might possibly be shared. I mean, all the quizzes usually come up with some kind of nebulous statement like, this quiz needs certain information to work. And then you're like, okay, whatever. But what you don't know is exactly what's being thrown out there.
Yeah, and that's what this quiz kind of shows. I mean, it's not an extensive quiz. It'll take you maybe 5 minutes to go through, but it'll open your eyes a little bit as to how insecure Facebook makes you. But in keeping up with our previous episode, which was the decade in review, we thought we would throw in a few topics related to television and media. There was a study done as far as television viewing, and people felt that reality TV was the biggest development for the last decade, from 2000 to 2009.
Right.
Biggest thing was, like, Survivor started in 2000, and that kind of led to the overwhelming onslaught of reality television. But some of the good shows that people noted as watching and enjoying were The Office, Conan O'Brien's late night show, Lost for its disaster
right.
appeal of a plane crash on a deserted island with
now
mystery.
There's a big mushroom cloud.
Yeah, it ended with a nuclear explosion at the end of the previous season, but this next upcoming season will be the final one. But as far as sci-fi, people really enjoyed Battlestar Galactica, really enjoyed the revitalization of Doctor Who. I guess it was off the air for about 15 years, and they brought in a new cast and sort of reinvented it, a little bit like they did Star Trek this year with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also Fringe for science fiction folks.
Oh, yes.
And 24 was also interesting to people because of the first season, they filmed it so that everything was in real time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were driving across town and it took 15 minutes to get there, you actually saw a clock that counted down that it was 15 minutes.
They don't do that anymore?
Not really. They've kind of abandoned that.
Oh, that's what made the show so interesting to me anyway, was that you could do everything, could get done in that real time, and that clock was there constantly counting down the minutes.
Yeah, so that was some of the shows that people found really useful. Really didn't give much information as to who did the survey as far as TV watchers. But another source that people are starting to go to is iTunes, as far as ratings for music and TV and videos. This past year, not to be surprising, the artist of the year was Michael Jackson.
No.
As soon as somebody passes away, everybody has to go out and grab his music like it's going to be disappearing.
I'm no exception. I know I did that.
But like, best new artist was Lady Gaga, which not too...
It's not necessarily very thrilling.
Yeah.
You're not missing much.
No, I figured it would be...
I think she's very talented in her own right, like been on Broadway and everything, but her music is just, well, not...
Could be.
Not very, I don't know, it's just sort of ho-hum to me.
Yeah, it's sort of the dance music that just, I don't know, we're not big into it, as you can already tell. But album of the year was kind of strange. Only by the Night, which was by Kings of Leon. I am not familiar with them whatsoever.
I mean, I have listened to the radio on and off this year, but I've never heard of that.
But the article that listed a lot of the information for iTunes ratings covered all the different areas, and we'll just post it out on the website with this episode and possibly even send it out on Twitter just so people can see what they know and what they do not know.
But all these reviews and things were done through iTunes.
You
can do that, which is something that I never really knew you could do.
Well, they have a rating system as far as how many people subscribe to things, how many people purchase, how many people have given positive reviews to say podcast and things like that. It's a little disturbing that the number one video podcast was Susie Orman, the financial advisor.
Ooh, put me to sleep.
But anyway, that's just kind of interesting reading to sort of see if you're up with what is hip in the world of iTunes.
Now, this doesn't really lead in very well to what I want to talk about next, but we're talking about digital technology, and now I'd like to switch a little bit and talk about the written word, which may be fast becoming arcane. I don't know. But with regard to blind people, the statistics on literacy are incredibly disturbing. And part of this has to do, at least in the developed world, the U.S. and other developed countries, with the advent of digital technology and screen readers, that in studies done recently, they've indicated that only about 1 in 10 of blind children in schools nowadays is taught to read Braille. That's more than a little disturbing. And people say, well, you know, I use screen readers, I do things by dictation, I don't know how to read. But that's okay, because I, you know, I can still function. I'm a very fluent, verbal, and intelligent person. And that all might be true. The article was in the New York Times, and it talked a lot about how people's brains are constructed based on whether you read or did not read, and other sort of cultural factors that fed into this. One of the main things that they talked about was that the impact of reading, whether it's reading by touch, reading by the written word, puts some organization into your life and into your thought processes. And this is one of the things that struck me. Some of the proponents for blind literacy were saying that people often who don't read and who, you know, rely on computers to do everything, A, they don't know how to spell. Well, they're spell checkers, so what do they need to know how to spell for? And B, their thought processes are very disorganized. A Canadian couple did a study with some children who were blind and only learned through audio input. And the article had a snippet of a story that one of the kids wrote who was 16, and I swear to God, it looked like a 2-year-old wrote it. A, the misspelling was atrocious. And B, above and beyond the spelling, the thoughts were just scattered in random. I mean, this person had 16. I can't believe this person was 16.
No, I can't believe you had one of my papers from when I was 16.
It was not you. It was some Canadian person. And I know you're not Canadian, seeing as how you don't think Canada is a separate country anyway. But in all seriousness, it was completely pathetic. And I don't want to impugn anyone personally here. I'm not trying to say that if you are blind and you can't read that you're a completely unintelligent person. I'm just saying it makes it harder based on our culture today for you to do the things that you need to do. And it makes it harder for you to fit in with everyone else and how everyone else processes thought and linguistics. So, you know, you got to take all those things into consideration. It's very, very sad. And it impacts a lot of us. We've been talking on Twitter about this, and the article points out something that I think is very true, that blind people a lot of times associate reading, there's something moral about reading. We associate it with independence, with something that we are morally almost obligated to do in order to be independent individuals. And for a lot of us, that's why I'm so disturbed by this, because that's kind of my attitude towards reading in general. Reading Braille, you know, we've only been able to read for 150 or so years. Do we really want to give all that up?
Well, and it affects job situations,
definitely.
Professional communications especially.
And there are some people in very high-level positions, blind people who have never read before, but they have to make use of things that a lot of us can't really afford. Aides, on their job with them, people shadowing them, basically, their whole entire work day to read them everything, to make sure that they get everything done that they need to get done, to revise the memos and reports that they dictate. So that, you know, people need all those accommodations. And if you can read, you don't need a lot of that. Now, this is where digital technology comes in and is going to save the day if companies actually pay attention and get themselves together on this. One main drawback to reading Braille, which a lot of people point out, is that it's very bulky and big, takes up enormous amounts of paper. And that's very true. But digital technology, like we said, has come a long ways. And there's this wonderful new technology called Braille displays. Basically, you hook it up to a computer and you can read on a display. Right now, it's metal pins that have different combinations. You can read the dots on the display as your computer screen changes and as you focus it in different parts. Now, the problem with these is that they are very expensive. There are some experimental models in development that are a lot cheaper, but I don't know how much energy is being focused into developing them. We talked about one when the podcast first started, and there's another one, I think, in Germany that is being developed also, that they don't depend on little motors, because that's what costs a lot, the little motors that govern the pins. They depended on magnetism, and that was apparently much cheaper to develop. But until they get these developed and up and running, we're still going to be in the same quandary. And if they get these up and running, it will make literacy hopefully more widespread, and children will be learning with those displays. It will be a little more expensive than having them learn just by audio, but if the displays are get cheaper, then not much more.
Plus, you can actually read without people having to hear or notice that you are reading.
Exactly.
I know you've mentioned that doing mediations, it would be good to have a Braille display just because you can read your notes without having to listen to something and try and listen to an actual client at the same time.
Right. And it's often hard, I mean, in the work that I do. Sometimes I'm having to write up payment plans and payment schedules, and it'd be great to be able to look at it and say, oh, okay, you paid this in this month and this one in the prior month, and now you need to pay this next month, and without having to look over and say, now, how much again did you pay? It would put it into some sort of framework for me, because I can keep track of things, but it would really help my concentration if I only had to concentrate on one thing at a time.
Well, and it also affects not being able to read Braille or actually write Braille. Mm-hmm. Would impact things just as simple as making notes with a stylus.
Yeah, I know. And it not being able to read, reading impacts your writing. So if you don't know how to read, like we said before, your thoughts aren't as organized and can be chaotic, and your writing suffers. And people who grew up not reading may not be aware of this and may not know this, but it really does. If you've got somebody writing for you, they're going to be correcting you, no matter if you think they're not. They are, because it's second nature for people to correct other people. And aside from that, the reading helps the thought organization. So if you're not able to write, your thoughts are very unorganized. I know that if I don't, a lot of times when I'm working with a partner, and it's the partner's job to write up the agreements we come to because, well, this leads into something we'll talk about later with the legal system's reliance on paper copy. But they write out the agreement, and I find my thoughts very unorganized if I can't write it down. I have to sit there and really think about it and how I would word things because I don't have the ability right there to write it in front of me. I have to dictate it, and that just doesn't sit well with me. And I know that in dictating it, my writing suffers, and I tend to lose track of things and leave things out if I'm not careful. So we've beat that to death, but I just wanted to try and communicate how very disturbed I was by this information. Digital technology is great. There are wonderful things on the horizon. I'm not saying it's bad, but I'm also saying people need to learn how to read in order to keep up with culture today.
Well, and we even see it on news groups and things like that.
Where people can't spell. They spell like they hear things. On news groups, if they're they spell like they hear things. So if they hear someone's name on TV, they'll spell it out phonetically. And you're like, that's not how it's spelled.
Yeah, I spot more of those than you do.
Yeah, but I also spot, I spot some too. People spell things the way they think that the screen reader pronounces it. That I see very often. That's very common. Speaking of assistive technology, there is an association called the Assistive Technology Industry Association, or ATIA, that basically a bunch of businesses are members of it, and they develop products for the visually impaired and try and get as much feedback as possible to make their products better through this association. ATIA is starting to hold conferences every year, kind of like CES. And CES, Consumer Electronics Show, is going on this week, I believe. And ATIA they're having a conference in Orlando, Florida, at the end of this month. I don't know whether it's pronounced ATIA, Asia, ATIA, or what. My screen reader says Asia. My southern husband says ATIA.
What are you saying?
Yeah, uh-huh, and I'll say ATIA.
How do you say Nokia? Mm-hmm. Nokia? Nokia?
I don't know. Ask the Finnish. They're the ones who invented it.
Or, as some people say, Nokia.
Ooh, now that's weird.
Yeah.
But I believe
that's how the Finnish say that you should say it. Is Nokia?
Nokia? Nokia? Well, maybe.
I'm going to Nokia you out.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway.
Well, I wanted to sort of highlight a couple of products that are going to be featured at that show. There is going to be a new version of the PlexTalk Pocket called the Bookport Plus that American Printing House is contracting. Essentially, many improvements over the PlexTalk Pocket, which is a digital talking book reader, similar to the Victor Reader Stream. Another program that's going to be improved is Freedom Scientific's open book scanning product. And it's going to, there are people who use this are going to be given an ability that I've had since I got my version of Kurzweil in 2019-99, something like that. They're going to be given the ability to start reading from the point at which they left off in a document. Now, that's kind of fundamental, and open book's been around for a while. I'm surprised they don't have this. Maybe I'm missing something. And the last one I wanted to talk about, because it's brand new, it's from the makers of the iPal. Abbasi, I believe, is how you pronounce the company's name. But they are coming out with something in conjunction with the iPal. It's a template to allow people to be able to read, scan, and recognize bills that they may get in the mail. So in other words, they may need sighted assistance to construct the template of, for instance, their cable bill. But then they'll take a picture of that bill that they receive every month, and the software will align it with the template and put the correct information in the correct places. Again, I don't really know a whole lot about how it's going to work. It sounds like this could already be done with other software, other OCR products, but, you know, I don't know. I think this is a more instantaneous result rather than scanning it in. And lastly, this is a crossover between ATIA and CES. The KNFB reader is going to be given to a wider audience. The KNFB reader is one of those that has been traditionally on the Nokia phones. Scanning and reading alternative, essentially you take a picture with your camera and it converts it into OCR, converts it into text, and it will read it to you through text-to-speech or a braille display, I believe, also. Well, now they are giving this a new face. A KNFB reader is now going to be marketed to the public as BLIO, Blio, a new software package that will not only work on mobile phones, but also tablet PCs and, I believe, regular computers.
Yes, there's going to be an application that you can use just like iTunes or something.
Yeah, and I don't know much about this. It's going to be unveiled at CES and ATIA as a crossover product, which that's great. And we'll know more when it, you know, when the unveiling happens, I guess you could say. So that's my ATIA products list. And I'd like to end my rant by saying, yay, there is now a keyboard, an add-on for Chrome that will enable people to navigate using the keyboard instead of just the mouse. Well, I can't even get Chrome screens to speak when I load Chrome, so I don't know how useful this is or how accessible it is. I haven't gotten the opportunity to try it yet. But it is on the CNET site, a link to download this free Chrome extension. So if you want to try it, you can go there and find it.
Yeah, I've used Chrome a little bit. I don't really find that much of a use for it other than it's a lot like Firefox. I don't see it as much of an advantage. Some people debate that you can actually download faster or surf the web faster, load pages faster, but I think it's probably just a relative term, faster.
Mm-hmm. Faster is always relative, yeah.
But in accessible news, sort of.
Other tip news.
Yes, other tip news, I guess you would say. In Windows 7 for users, there is a God mode that will allow you to see a lot more of the settings that you can modify all in one place. We just did this a few minutes ago, and it's quite impressive with all the settings.
I don't know if Microsoft actually calls it God mode or what, but it is sort of an Easter egg, and they did put it in there. You know, it's kind of an Easter egg. You can call it the folder whatever you want. You can have whatever name you want to it, but we like to call it God mode. Essentially, what you do is you go into your desktop and create a new folder. The actual name of the folder can be whatever you want. We called ours God mode. And the extension is a huge list of characters, and it's very important to include all of them. But once you do that, you can go to your desktop, the folder will appear as an icon, and you click it, and just hordes of settings pop up. It's the control panel to the nth degree, essentially.
Yeah, it gives you a lot of the settings that you have to go around to multiple screens and multiple panels all in one place as a folder. Once you actually enter the command, it will take away the long string of characters off of your desktop. So it just shows up as whatever you name that particular folder. I guess whoever discovered this Easter egg gave it the name God Mode, kind of from PC gaming, because used to be you could give a command while you were playing a game that would give you all strength and weaponry, and stamina and all of that, and people referred to it as God Mode. So maybe that's where it came from. But anyway, I will attempt to read the long key.
Oh, yes.
That you have to type in, and so, hopefully it makes sense, and hopefully I don't lose my place.
So naming the folder God Mode, period.
And then you will put a open curly brace. You'll put ED-7B-A-4-7-0-8E-5-4-4-6-5-E-8-2-5-C-9-9-7-1-2-0-4-3-E-0-1-C. And then put a closing curly brace.
And the curly braces are the shift with the bracket keys.
Yes.
So the shift left bracket is the left curly brace, and shift right bracket is the right curly brace.
Yes.
You out of breath yet?
You want those enclosed in there, and you can use your Victor Reader Stream or whatever you listen to this podcast in order to back that up, because I'm not saying it again. And no court in the world is going to make me say it again.
Speaking of courts.
Oh, segue.
Segue.
Drink.
Speaking of courts, and this goes back to what I was talking about earlier with literacy, when I said that court systems love paper. Yes, they do. Everything is on paper. In Great Britain somewhere, a judge asked counsel to produce this huge file of documents, and the counsel said no, they won't produce it digitally because they're afraid of violating some kind of law over there. Well, it just turned out they were afraid of having the documents on a disk and potentially losing the information, dropping the disk, I don't know, down the drain or in the train somewhere, or somehow losing the information. So the article was saying essentially, well, that just means lawyers are afraid of computers. The judge ordered them to produce the information digitally rather than on paper.
Well, but, I believe he was produced with like a 4 or 5 inch thick document that is just ridiculous.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. It was this huge amount of paper, and he said he didn't understand what the counsel was driving at, because he had been using digital information for on and off for 30 years in more or less, you know, smaller and larger quantities, and never had had a problem or been accused of violating whatever this Data Protection Act or whatever this law is over there. So this highlights a problem not only in Great Britain but in the U.S. with our court system. Mounds of paper everywhere. It makes me hard to do my job because I'm constricted by the way the court does things. And they do paper. I mean, that's just the way it is. Everything's on paper. But, you know, we work with that and, you know, get things done regardless. But it does make, I mean, it's like they're living in the middle of the 20th century rather than at the beginning of the 21st. The article does point something out that I've known for a long time and that we've, you know, talked about it as well, that if they went digital, a whole lot of people would be out of work because they have staffs of clerks dedicated to processing paper. That's all they do all day long is run paper for this, you know, all these cases. They have all these people, and it's a lot of people dedicated to this. And if we all went digital, they'd be out of work.
Well, in defense of the lawyers, I believe it was back in the spring, the British police force, I believe it was, or one of their upper security agencies actually lost a hard drive with a lot of personal data for residents on them. Residents, personal information, and it was not recovered. So nobody really knew what happened to that. There's also been a couple other instances where people had burned a CD or something and actually had it couriered from one place to another. And then when it gets to the location, that disc is nowhere to be found. So it sounds like, yeah, digital is safe, but it also depends on,
it can be easily lost.
Well,
if you're not
it depends on who's handling it. Definitely. So that may play a little bit into the situation, because I know it made big worldwide news.
Yeah, I remember hearing that.
Earlier in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Other legal news.
Texas County, Texas. I guess they couldn't come up with a unique name. There is a prosecutor in the court system that is planning to use Twitter in an interesting way, or I guess planned to use Twitter in an interesting way, because during Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve, he was planning to release names of drunk drivers on Twitter in an attempt to shame them into not drinking heavily on the holiday celebratory evenings. There's not really a report as to how that happened or how it occurred and what the success rate was, seeing as how usually if people are drinking and driving and they know the consequences, a lot of times that really doesn't matter and they could probably care less.
But it would be interesting to get some statistics as to whether it was actually done and if anything actually happened as a result. You know, if the arrests were fewer or what. I mean,
a lot of people know what Twitter is, but I don't know if a lot of people actually use Twitter.
Right.
So I don't know what kind of an incentive that would be. I mean, if somebody's a chronic alcoholic.
Or if someone's a big-time criminal, they're not going to care, you know.
No, not at all.
We are going to end this podcast with a
What Were They Thinking
segment.
There was a report of a couple there was a couple driving through Oregon, and they were following their GPS directions. It was a Mr. and Mrs. Rhodes. The wife's name was Starry Rhodes. Scary enough.
Starry Bush Rhodes.
Yes. But Starry is the key to that.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this couple followed their GPS. It kept leading them in strange directions, turning left, turning right, just continuing and continuing on, to the point that after a couple days, their GPS started losing.
Well, you're missing the point of actually what happened. The article was written to be pretty sensational. I was reading after I read the article. I just couldn't believe it, so I went and read some more. And essentially what happened was these people admittedly didn't really know what they were doing, were, you know, very dependent on their GPS, probably more than they should be. They turned off onto this like forest road or service road or something, and got stuck in a snowbank. It's not like they were just out there driving around for 3 days. They were stuck in a snowbank.
The article was written, they kept going for like 2 days.
Yeah, it was pretty inaccurate.
Going for 2 days to the point that they were just totally lost and didn't know where they were at. And then they called the police and sent their coordinates just as their GPS was slowly starting to get out of range of a signal. Just kind of craziness that, I mean, you hear all the time of people driving onto railroad tracks or driving off into a lake or something because they were literally following their GPS.
Mm-hmm. And I think their deal was they got stuck in a snowbank. Now, exactly what happened for the 2.5 or so days they were stuck in it and why they couldn't get a signal out, I'm not really sure to call for help. But they did eventually get help, and the people got them out with a winch. And, you know, they were fine. But even if the article was written to be sort of sensational, it still is a sort of what were they thinking, in the sense of people just rely way too much on their GPS. If you turn off onto a forest road, very minor road, and you're trying to get to another state, wouldn't you kind of think, this might not be right?
Yeah, it's definitely one of those thinking questions when it comes to following a device absolutely as gospel.
Yeah, and people do that a lot, you know. Everyone's guilty of it to a certain extent, but there are situations in which you really shouldn't, and GPS is one of them. Do you have anything else you would like to mention before we wrap this up?
Do not have any more stories, no.
All righty. Well, I would, as a last thing, encourage any of you who are interested in assistive technology and learning to use your computers more effectively to check out Accessible World's calendar for January. They have a new presenter named Dan Thompson, who will be presenting. His first presentation will be next Tuesday at 9 p.m., January 12th. And he will be presenting and giving tips on how to use your computer more effectively, safely, and securely. Apparently, this is a once-a-month presenter who's new, and you can check out and find more information about Accessible World by going to accessibleworld.org.
I wonder if he knows about the ACLU quiz.
I don't know. I'll have to go on there next Tuesday, just to ask him. So that's all we have for today. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great week.
Bye-bye.
To contact the team for Tech Access Weekly, send an email to techaccessweekly@gmail.com, or you may leave a voice message at 260-2-ASK-TAW, 260-227-5829. Please visit our website at techaccessweekly.com.